wise man and a fool side by side. Which one is you? Fool, I played once before. That was then, and this is new.
That was a section of Darkness in Mind, a track from drummer and producer Casa Overall's album I Think I'm Good, which will be out February 28th. It's his second album, and it's a really remarkable piece of art. It features appearances from a tremendous roster of young and established New York jazz musicians, including vibraphonist Joel Ross, multi-instrumentalist Morgan Guerin, harpist Brandy Younger, trumpeter Theo Croker, and pianists Sullivan Fortner, Craig Taborn, Aaron Parks, and Vijay Iyer. Casa Overall is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. This is our 50th episode, which is an exciting milestone for me, anyway, and I hope you'll check out any previous episodes that you may have missed on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts. I've had some incredible guests on this show since it began in 2017, people I never thought I'd get the chance to talk to, and I'm hoping the next 50 episodes will be as exciting as the ones that are already out there. Casa Overall is a really exciting musician. He's much more than just a drummer, although he's a monster behind the kit. He was a member of pianist Jerry Allen's band for several years. He's played with Vijay Iyer, Theo Croker, and he's a member of drummer Terry Lynn Carrington's band Social Science right now. But his own albums, Go Get Ice Cream and Listen to Jazz, and now I Think I'm Good, are a really unique blend of jazz, hip-hop, and electronic music. They're not so much virtuosic displays of instrumental technique as they are intimate kind of audio diary keeping in the way a lot of hip-hop is now. Last year, he had a six-month residency at the Jazz Gallery in New York. Once a month between January and June, he played with a different pianist with each set recorded. I saw the first show where his duo partner was Jason Moran, but it turned out to be a trio set because bassist Evan Flory Barnes was added to the lineup. They played for almost 90 minutes, including music by Ravel and by Jerry Allen, And there was also some sound manipulation going on from the board, kind of like a live dub mix. Overall style behind the kit is swinging, but it can be kind of blocky too. At the show that I saw, he seemed happier locking into a hip-hop groove with Flory Barnes than swinging in a conventional sense, and his drum solos had some real aggression to them. That's kind of one of the things we talk about in this interview, the fact that musicians under 40, who grew up in a world where hip-hop was basically the dominant form of black music and eventually pop music as a whole, they have an approach to jazz that's fundamentally different than people older than them. Even players from previous generations who have a real and deep interest in and an openness to hip-hop as an element in their music, like Herbie Hancock, for example. Even guys like that always approach it from the outside, whereas a guy like Casa just lives in it like a fish lives in water. So that informs our whole conversation, which covers his time with Jerry Allen, his new record, and particularly some of the lyrics on it, the actual sound of the music. We talk about his singing style and a lot more. It's a really interesting interview, and I hope you enjoy it. There are a few sound problems here and there, which I own and I apologize for in advance, but it's a compelling enough conversation that I think suffering through a couple of dropouts here and there is worth it. Before we dive in, though, I want to tell you about a cause that Osiris is supporting at the moment, which is the Mockingbird Foundation. Did you know that music can accelerate child brain development and strengthen intellectual, emotional, and motor skills, as well as overall literacy? Bringing music into the classroom can help kids explore the mind-body connection and become comfortable with self-expression. Sadly, many children's music programs are lacking in the resources they need to let kids explore this creative space. That's why Osiris is happy to partner with the Mockingbird Foundation. Founded in 1996, the Mockingbird Foundation is a volunteer-run nonprofit organization dedicated to improving access to music education for America's youth. Each year, the foundation awards grants to dozens of music education programs and funds those grants through a combination of fundraising, publishing, and the curation of Phish.net, one of the earliest internet fan communities. Mockingbird is entirely volunteer with no staff, no salaries, and no office, so every dollar really does make a difference in providing children's music programs with the staffing, instruments, and support they need. The foundation gives over $150,000 every year in grants. To donate or to learn more, visit mbird.org. That's mbird.org. And on that note, I'm going to play one more piece of music. This is a little bit of Was She Happy, which is dedicated to Jerry Allen and features Vijay Iyer. And after that, you'll hear my conversation with Casa Overall. Thank you.
Was she happy?
She was on a quest. She was on a journey.
Was she happy?
My first question is, how old are you?
Oh yeah, I am. I have to think about it. I'm 37.
Okay. So I was guessing about 35. Yeah.
Yeah. Wikipedia says 39.
Oh really?
But
oh okay.
Hopefully that'll change soon.
I didn't even look. I didn't assume you would have a page yet. But yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
My guess was about 35 because I looked at like roughly when you were in school and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
That kind of leads me to my first question, because being under 40, that
mm-hmm.
puts you and me in different worlds in a way, because I can remember a world before hip hop because I'm 48. And you came into the world and hip hop was the thing. Like you, I'm assuming, grew up knowing it as the dominant form of music, you know, whereas I grew up and saw it emerge. Like all of a sudden there was this thing called rap music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Who were your favorite rappers growing up?
Well, okay, so just to, if I may answer the question paragraphically, I'll just give you a quick memory. I remember some of my earliest memories, I remember my brother, who was 4 years older than me, and he had the red jacket with all the zippers, like Michael Jackson and Thriller.
Uh-huh.
And just that whole culture, you know, it almost wasn't even fully crystallized as hip-hop at the time, but it was like the hip hop thing and Michael and the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 80s, and it was a whole kind of energy, you know. So for me, it wasn't just hip hop, but it was definitely hip hop was the center force of it. But it was like, it was a lot, you know. But for me, being so young, around 80. What are we talking about? 87, 86, 88. I really like the stuff that kids get into. You know what I mean? It took me a while to get into the real serious political rap. But, like, my favorite record was DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Rock the House, you know? And I had it on vinyl. Somehow we had it on vinyl. And Will Smith used to tell those, like, story raps, you know? It
mm-hmm.
would be like, this is what happened. I woke up at 10 and da-da-da-da-da. I saw my friends, and it was always like, and for a little kid, it was just so entertaining, you know, fun. But then I also was really into Public Enemy. And Fight the Power was, like, a huge hit around the time Do the Right Thing came out. And I was really into that. And I also, because my brother was 4 years older than me, I heard some of the stuff I wasn't really supposed to be hearing a little early, too. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
One of my other early rap memories was my brother was like, I want the new DJ Quick tape. Born and Raised in Compton, I think is what it was called. It was, you know, beginning phases of gangster rap, and that's all he was talking about. And so my dad got it for him for Kwanzaa, because we were celebrating Kwanzaa at the time. And the night before my dad gave him the tape, he listened to the record. You know, he listened to the tape before he gave it to us to listen to, and he said, "Hey, look, like I listened to this last night. There's a lot of stuff on here you shouldn't be listening to." You know, it was real, you know, a lot of cussing, a lot of violence, a lot of, you know, hypersexual. And he gave me a lesson, though. He said, I'm going to give you guys this tape, but remember that this is art, you know, and this music on here is, you know, one person's experiences, and it's a certain part of reality that, you know, artistically needs representation, but this is not a role model, and this doesn't mean go out and do this stuff, but there is something to learn from people that live this life, you know. And I remember my dad giving me that lesson early, and I think it stuck with me because I listen to a lot of different kind of music as far as messages or positive, negative polarity, and I try to find something in everything, you know.
Do you still feel as tied to hip-hop as you did when you were younger, or do you get generation-gapped sometimes, to use that as a verb? Like, because I feel like I've aged out of it, I'll be honest. Like, I had an era with hip-hop, you know, and it was 86 to maybe 92 or 93. And with very few exceptions, I can't really connect with it anymore after that. Like, these days it feels to me like music by and for teenagers. But I mean, back then I saw Ice-T, I saw Public Enemy, you know, I went to shows and stuff like that. And but now it's like, you know, there's only a couple of guys that I like, living or still active rappers that I even, you know, listen to. But
totally. I agree. For the most part, I agree with you. There's like, I would say that when it comes to me listening, a lot of the rap that I really listen to a lot comes from the same time period, you know, between 93 and 98, you know, for me. That was when I had that little moment, you know, Tupac and Snoop and everybody, you know, E-40 and all of that, you know. But at the same time, I do still check for what's happening in the now, as far as like the, you know, the teenage, what you said about the teenager, music for teenagers, it's kind of like there's always a evolution of the trend of the moment, you know, like if you listen to the bass drum pattern that's popular, like every year, for me, every year or so, the popular rhythm or clave, if you will, of the bass drum changes a little bit. And if you really listen to what's popular on the radio or in the clubs or, you know, just coming out of like the current popular, you know, black music, hip hop trend, it's almost like clockwork. You'll be like, man, every beat has this certain pattern, you know, and then like a year or so later, it'll just change a little bit, you know. So I still find the way it slowly evolves in these very minuscule ways quite fascinating, and I study that in a sense, you know. It's like but I don't get the same kind of like excitement. Like, I don't relate to it the same way I used to. You know, because a lot of times it feels like it's a lot of the same ideas recooked, you know. And so once you start to grow out of certain ways of looking at the world, or maybe not outgrow but expand, you kind of like, I can't keep, you know, reading the same book over and over, you know. Like, I get that book now. So it needs to be, on a writing level, if I'm going to get into an artist, it needs to have something more than what I've already gotten, which is a lot from hip-hop. You know, I've learned so much from the writers in hip-hop that when somebody brings something new, then I'm like, oh, shoot, I never thought about that. So let me get into this cat. And then sometimes the track is just hot. You know, it could be, sometimes I'll hear a new song, and I just be like, man, I feel this one, though, you know, and I get into it.
Yeah, I feel like even though I'm not paying attention to what's going on in hip-hop proper, like, I feel like I still get a certain amount of it secondhand because I hear the stuff that, like, players like Christian Scott or Keon Harold or people like that are borrowing. You know, so when you were talking about how the beats change up, like when I hear the beats on like a Christian Scott album, I'm like, okay, that I can tell that that came from someplace, and I may not know the whole scene that it came out of, but I can appreciate the rhythmic aspects of that in this other context.
Totally. And that's, I feel like that's one thing about the one thing that hip hop doesn't get enough credit for is that it affects everything, you know? And we're not even talking literally sonically, but like hip hop as a force, as a culture, as an energy, it affects like the whole world, you know? It affects the beats from these kind of so like the artist that you named, but it also affects the beats in the next pop star, you know what I mean? It affects everything, and it even affects the fashion and style world, and it just, you know what I mean, it affects everything, and it's amazing to me that it still does, you know, just as much as it has in the past. It doesn't seem like it's slowing down, you know.
Yeah. Do you remember, you know, because listening to this stuff growing up, like it's a way of understanding music in a way. So do you remember when you started to kind of piece together how music worked? Like how old were you when you started, like, you know, conceptualizing tracks and, you know, things like that?
I would say pretty early. That's probably one of the things, one of the most fortunate aspects of my upbringing. I was born in a musical household, you know, both my parents are amateur musicians. My brother got a drum set when he was four and when I was born. So I was trying to learn drums as soon as I could get up there on a drum set. And just trying to emulate, you know, the drums from Charlie Parker to like playing a one drop rhythm from the Bob Marley records to even messing around with a few beat machines as a pretty young age, it was like I understood the idea of what was going on really, really early, you know. Couldn't tell you the exact time, but, you know, I'm talking about being pretty young when I was, you know, taking a tape deck and recording a drum thing to that and trying to play guitar to it and kind of just this early entry in production, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, like, you know, a lot of reggae and dub, you know, you can hear a lot of production, you know, effects and things like that. And just having instruments laying around and, you know, hearing stuff and trying to emulate it, you know, is quite natural.
See, I feel like that's where I went wrong. Like, because when I feel like if my musical education had started with rhythm, I might be a musician today. But it started with melody because I was given a violin in like the third grade. And it just wasn't happening, you know, learning scales and learning bowing technique and all that stuff. And I was just like, this is way too much practice for way too little reward, you know.
I mean, the thing about rhythm and drums and stuff is that you don't have to be a musician. Like everybody that all your friends were in tune with the grooves and stuff. And the way we would listen to rap, the way I would listen to rap, it's like I would listen to a tape over and over and over and over. I'm sure you were the same way until you like memorize and understand every lyric, you know what I mean, and every grunt and ad lib. So listening to music like that, I think I would get pretty familiar with what was going on rhythmically too, and with the production, you know, and just the sound.
Yeah, exactly. So how did you find jazz? Like, you know, was it something that was in the house as well? I mean,
totally. My dad was born in 1937, and so he had me a little bit later than normal, and he was playing on vinyl. He was playing Monk, Miles, Bird, Train, Ornette, Sun Ra. Let me think. You know, just like and some of the outside records too. You know, not just Kinda Blue. Kinda Blue was there too, but like I was getting exposed to some pretty far out harmonic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get that much Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson, you know, at home. You know, it was more like jazz and Eastern, you know, Indian classical music and reggae and some folk and stuff. So it was kind of a different bag of stuff in comparison to my friends. And because of that, the way I hear music, when something sounds too straight, you know, like rhythmically or harmonically, it's like too down the middle, it doesn't sound right to me. You know, for me, when I hear some of those chords that Monk would play, you know, the kind of clusters and just some of that kind of, it sounds like a little dissonant. That sounds like harmonic to me, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds normal, you know? And so, yeah, that's an answer with the answer on top.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when I've been thinking more and more about Monk recently, like in recent years, and because I read the biography of him just at the end of last year, and but for years I've been thinking that he's one of those musicians that's like the perfect introduction to jazz for like little kids, because a lot of the way he plays and his melodies and stuff, it's almost like if you close your eyes, it's like a Muppet Show kind of a jazz.
Mm,
you know, it's got that kind of cartoonish aspect almost, you know, where you can see a little kid being really attracted to that because it sounds almost wrong, you know.
Exactly. It has a childlike quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really interesting that you said that. Like when I talk about listening or seeing Elvin Jones play, it's like sometimes I'll say to somebody, have you ever seen like a toddler play drums for the first time, and the way they hit everything and kind of they discover the sounds, you mm-hmm. know, they hit the snare and the cymbal and the hi-hat, it's like they hit it and they listen to it as they hit it and they go, whoa, what was that? And it's like a childlike discovery way of approaching. And there was one other thing that I thought was pertinent to the Monk. Right. So this is another thing. Like I'm not a singer, right? I wouldn't consider myself a singer, and I don't think I can sing with quotes on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've often thought about, like, maybe I should just go take vocal lessons, try to get good at singing, you know? And what I realized is that part of the quality in my, you know, vocals and stuff is the fact that it's, like, bad, you know? And I hate to say that in comparison to Monk, but I mean in the fact that it's, like, not trying to be pretty, mm-hmm. you know? I'm not trying to say, look, let me show you this perfectly tuned thing, you know? It's, like, almost like singing in the shower and giving people that feeling of, like, okay, like, anybody could do this, you know, like if you can walk, you can dance, if you could talk, you could sing kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And think that, like, I actually, at this point, it's almost intentional of, like, there's certain things that I do well and I try to do as good as I can, and I want to do better and better and keep getting better at, and then there's certain things I like to just throw the paint at the wall, you know, and just let it be raw and ugly. And then I spend hours, you know, maybe putting the frame on it or coloring it in right or whatever. And that's a nice balance for me as far as the kind of music I like, you know.
I feel like there's a whole sort of unacknowledged vocal lineage that goes Louis Armstrong to like Howlin' Wolf to like Screamin' Jay Hawkins to, you know, there's probably somebody in the middle, and then you get to Biz Markie and Old Dirty Bastard, you know?
Yeah, ODB. Especially ODB. Yeah. That's amazing. Because there's this documentary on, it was on MTV, but now it's on YouTube, right? About Old Dirty Bastard when he got out of jail, trying to get his career back, and it shows him in the studio singing on a song he had with Pharrell. It's one of his like comeback songs, and it shows him singing it like first take, and it just sounded so raw but so perfect. Like it was just perfect, you know. It sounded so good. I was like, does he have perfect pitch and just like never tried to develop it, you know? Like, is it just like he could have been an incredible singer because it sounded so good, you know. and I think you could also add to that list, not necessarily in that lineage, but definitely in the same conversation, is a singer like Jimi Hendrix or a singer like Bob Dylan. You know, because it's like they're talking, you know, they're telling a truth that needs to be heard. So it's like, if it's not pretty enough for you, then, you know, good, you know, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you went to Oberlin, right?
I did. Oberlin Conservatory of Music, the major in jazz performance.
Uh-huh. And when did you, is that where you came into Jerry Allen's band? Or was that?
No, I started playing with Jerry Allen after I moved to New York in 2007.
Okay.
After I graduated, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to know her and get that gig?
So Jerry, I met, back when I met Jerry, she was with Wallace Roney. We're together. And I met Wallace actually at Jazz and Snowmass, the like school. It's like a summer week intense connected to Lincoln Center, I believe. And teaching at this school was Wallace Roney, Chrissy McBride, Ben Green, Russell Malone, Louis Nash, and a couple other cats. And that's why I met Wallace, and he really liked my drumming and was like, you know, come to New York, join the band, blah, blah, blah. And so eventually I moved to New York after I graduated. And so, yeah, I met Jerry during that time. And Wallace didn't hire me to be in his band right away. You know, it's kind of like hang out, hang around. And but Jerry was like, you sound good, you know, are you busy this summer? I was like, yeah, you know, I think I got some dates open, you know. And yeah, and then so, you know, her manager Orr Harris hit me up in the summer, I think it was the summer of 2007, I did my first tour ever. We went to Europe, and Carmen Lundy was on that tour, and I actually did a date yesterday with my band, Blue Suamini. It's like some of my other projects, and it was featuring Carmen Lundy at the Kennedy Center. And in celebration of Jerry, I put up, there's a song called Well Done on her album Timeless Portraits and Dreams that Carmen was featured on, that we played on that tour. And so I just played it last night for the first time in like 10 years or something. Yeah.
Yeah, she's somebody. Jerry is somebody that's like a big blind spot for me, because for some reason, not out of, you know, deliberate choice or anything, but I never really listened to much of her music. So as someone who was in the band, you know, what can you say about her musical concept and what, you know, she wanted from you and, you know, like what you took away from it, you know, stuff like that?
Well, I think she was a very understated artist and an understated person, meaning she could play really aggressive and exciting, but some of the best stuff she played, if you weren't paying attention, you could, like, you know, you'd not notice. You know, it's like she had a real subtle quality to her playing and even her harmonics. I'm not really a advanced harmonic person when it comes to explanation, but I know that she could play some really outside chords or substitution chords, but it still didn't sound out, you know, like she could make out sound pretty, and she just had this real amorphous quality to her playing and very cloudy. You know, it was a lot about, you know, you could, it's a lot of nature in her playing, you know what I mean? It, things sound like clouds or the ocean or rain, that kind of thing. And one thing I noticed, here's an interesting thing as far as what she wanted from me. I feel like I didn't understand that you need different ingredients for a recipe. And so when she would play, she would be playing real floaty around the time. And I kind of approached the time floaty as well. And so I would be out in floaty world with her. And I realized that she needed some of that Jimmy Cobb, like, clarity and marking, you know, in order for her to float around it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, That was really hard for me to get together, because her stuff, she'd be laying back behind the beat and different things, and I would go with her, you know, and so the tempos slow down a lot, and, you know, and Kenny Davis, very solid bassist, you know, he would be like, Casa, he'd be looking at me like, you know, nodding his head like, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm out in space with Jerry, you know, and, so I really had to learn how to be able to go out in space, but to keep an anchor, no matter how far out I go, I had to make sure to have an anchor to get back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I've learned so many things from her, and it's like I'm still learning from her, you know, now, because playing some of her music and listening to some of her stuff, I'm hearing things that I hadn't heard back when I was playing. You know, I couldn't hear it yet, but that's just one of the many things.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, because that kind of reminds me of something I read a few years ago, was an interview with Ben Reilly, and he was talking about drumming for Monk, and he said, you know, Monk wanted a really straight up and down, like a heavy beat. Like, he wanted, you know, whoever was in his band, he basically wanted, like, Sam Woodyard from Duke Ellington's band, you know, that straight ahead beat. Because he was going to wander all over the place, but he needed the drummer to you know, pound nails into the floor, basically, you know.
And that speaks to what you were saying before with the big blocks and stuff, you know. And I think that's by design, because sometimes you need something for the listener to, like, understand. It's like a key, you know, a compass, you know. It's like, if you want, people can hear the outside stuff if they know where, you know, like what kind of box for putting stuff in. It's a little easier, you know.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was listening to last week, I was listening to some stuff by Cecil Taylor's Feel Trio, which was him and William Parker and Tony Oxley on drums. And Cecil obviously was all over everywhere, and so was Oxley. He was, like, all over the kit, you know. And when you listen, you hear that William is the anchor. Like, he's just straight down the middle, you know, almost walking,
half the time. Yeah, you know, yeah, and you're like, wait, but this, you know, and you realize that somebody has to play that part, you know?
Somebody, yeah. I agree. I think so. I mean, you know, maybe not, like, but I think it works. Like, there's a sense, there's a logic to it, you know? And sometimes it's just one of my limbs, you know, these days. Still thinking about that same thing, but sometimes I'm going, like, even if it's just for the band, I give some consistent little thing, and then everything else is like out to lunch.
Yeah,
which is a good record.
on that live record that you did with Jerry Allen, you were working with a tap dancer.
Yeah.
Did you have to work out stuff with him in advance? Because I kind of imagine that, you know, a tap dancer's parts would be more codified and rehearsed than the rest of the band. Or was he improvising too?
He was improvising a lot, and that was actually kind of part of the mission statement of the project. You know, it was like, you have this lineage of drum and dance that goes back to Africa that has a moment in when it came together with tap dancing and drum and jazz and jazz music. And it was kind of constrained to a limited use. You know, it was more connected to the entertainment part of jazz. And like you said, more like, did you say codified?
Yeah, like I feel like his parts, yeah, you know, he would have figured them more out, like, more in
exactly,
advance.
Exactly, exactly. And the thing is that I think Jerry was like, look, we can take that concept and do the same thing with it, you know. So he was up at Compton, he was interacting and doing the whole nine, you know what I mean? It was almost like, as far as the setup of the group, it was almost like having a percussionist or like a, maybe having a tabla player in the band,
mm-hmm,
you know, because actually a tabla player is a great metaphor, because a tabla player does have a lot of like rhythms that will play on certain types of grooves consistently. Like, they play this kind of groove on that type of groove and that kind of thing, and also like patterns, but mm-hmm, at the same time they're not limited by those patterns. They can take those patterns and, you know, do them three times and do them in seven, you know, improvise and everything. And so I think that was the that was like the hypothesis and goal of that project.
So this new record that you've got coming out, which I guess, uh-huh, is coming out at the end of February.
February 28th, yes.
Yeah.
My apologies for any wrong dates and things, you know. it happens.
So you just premiered it from, you premiered the music at Winter Jazz Fest this year, right?
Yeah, we did about five tracks on it.
Mm-hmm. And how did it go? Was it like, you know, was it well received, you know?
It was really well received. It might have been the best show I've had yet. In my career, as far as this kind of project, I think that, let me think about this for a second. I think that music is important to me, right? In the sense of, like, it means a lot to me. And so I put as much, and it doesn't have the kind of ear candy as some of my earlier stuff. So I put as much into like making it sound as great as possible on the record. And I think equally with the live show, I'm really trying to not cut any corners and like figure out like how can I get this message across live and make it sound great and also leave space for you know, full like freedom for improvisation and exploration within these, you know, boxes, you know. And yeah, it was received really well. And I think people are connecting with the fact that the content is a little deeper, you know. And so it's like, whether you're a music head or not, you know, when you start getting into some emotive material, you know, people tend to say, "Oh, let me check this out."
Yeah, there's a lot of imagery of like prison and confinement and stuff in the lyrics. So, I mean, why is that such a compelling metaphor and theme for you?
I think that for me, first off, like the whole album is kind of dealing with my relationship with mental illness in the past, or you know, whatever you want to call that. And for me, being not being in touch with those feelings or understanding them is a certain kind of confinement, you know, or not being able to express them clearly. And you know, so I went in twice, you know, to the mental hospital and spent 10 days, you know, locked up, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess after those experiences, it feels like, even though I've never been to jail, it feels like I have, you know what I mean? And then it's also kind of a metaphor, because the idea of taking medications or taking anything to cool out your brain is kind of like a certain kind of confinement in itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I actually don't take anything these days. You know, it's been a few years I haven't been taking any kind of medication or anything. But when I was, one of the things that was frustrating was I felt like I wasn't reaching my potential creatively. I felt like it was like, man, I can't really get to it like I want to. I feel blocked, you know? So I think it's a metaphor for a lot of different kind of aspects of my life, and I'm just kind of trying to dive into it poetically, you know?
Yeah. I feel like that's a subject that, and this is true also of, it is something that's emerged. It's only in the last couple of years, I feel like, that's a subject that musicians have been really comfortable addressing openly, like whether it's in pop music or in like metal and punk and stuff like that, you know, and in hip hop and R&B as well. Like, I feel like that's, you know, that's a new thing. Like, it used to be something that people didn't talk about or didn't sing about, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's interesting too, because it's almost like there's always a trend happening, you know, whether the trend is like more happy and uplifting, or sometimes the trend gets more like depressive or down, kind of like during the grunge era in Seattle, or wherever it was started in Seattle. But I think that it kind of became a trend recently, in the past couple of years, especially in rap. And it was almost like it made me feel a little like it was like I just didn't like the fact that it felt like a put on thing, you know, because it's like, it's really, if you're really dealing with that stuff, it's not something that you really want to be, it's not something you're really like proud of, you know what I mean? And I think that there was a stigma of it. I remember back in high school, actually, I remember somebody mentioning like somebody had manic depression, you know, and just the term itself was just like, that means you're like nuts. You know what I mean? I didn't even know what it meant. It was just like, oh my God, that's whole other stuff, you know? And so I don't know why it changed, but I think that the fact is that so many artists are dealing with some version of some level of some kind of mental sensitivity that it's like, it's actually so common, you know, and some people are dealing with it in the sense of like, they know they've been diagnosed with this and they know what it is and this and that. And then you have other cats that are just like, wow, you know, like they just drink too much, you know, or whatever. And they probably could be diagnosed with something too, but it seems like so common for like so many great artists to have been troubled. And I think it's like, I hope that we're getting into a place where like you don't have to be like, you don't have to go down in flames to be an artist anymore, you know, or to be a sensitive artist, you know, like hopefully the society can change enough to where, you know, putting everything into your work doesn't mean you have to like fall apart, you know, via the society and the industry and all that stuff, you know, like I hope to see that change, you know.
It's funny, like I think there's a band that doesn't get enough credit for this, like as really as pioneers in a way, and it's like right there in the name is the band Suicidal Tendencies. Like in the 80s, we're talking about, you know, depression and, you know, raw emotions and stuff like that in a context of like really heavy thrash metal. And it kind of, in a way, it kind of opened the door for other bands to talk about that kind of stuff, you know, years later on their records. And I feel like they don't get the, you know, they don't get enough credit for being that, you know, sort of emotionally open at a time when nobody else was doing it.
Yeah, I think I probably should check them out more as well. You know, I mean, I know the band name and I kind of know the idea, but I don't think I took the time to really decode it the real and understand where it's coming from as well. You know, maybe, I don't know if this is just a theory, but maybe their lyrics and stuff, I would assume they're pretty, like, is it easy to understand everything they're saying, or is it real, like, almost coded?
No, they're pretty straightforward. I mean, they had an album that was called How Will I Laugh Tomorrow When I Can't Even Smile Today?
Oof. Yeah.
And it's like, man, you know, all right.
Yeah. I'm gonna check some of that out, man. Sure.
So tell me about recording this album, because I read that you did most of it basically with like a laptop and one microphone, right? In terms of capturing the instruments. So what kind of software did you use for mixing and stuff like that?
So, okay. So this is the thing. I think that when I tried to explain this in the past, a lot of people say, well, that's how everybody makes music now. You know, like that's not anything particularly special, you know, like that's the way everybody makes music these days. But I think that one thing is that I'm kind of pushing the detail, you know, I'm pushing the detail with the concept. So to explain that, I'll just break down one of the songs for you. I had a duo concert with Craig Taborn at the Jazz Gallery that I recorded. Like, we recorded it. We recorded the board recording, you know, like stems. Like, we really recorded every track. And I took 8 measures of Craig improvising. And then after it was all done, you know, I took it home a few weeks later. And I took 8 measures of Craig and looped it up, and then I took like a couple vocal isms that I made during the show, and I made like a beatbox loop out of it, and let me think for a second. Yeah, so then I made this little skeleton song out of the live performance, and then performed another performance at the Jazz Gallery with the full band on top of that, right? And came up with some lyrics, which ended up being the Show Me a Prison lyrics from the album that were taken from a Phil Oaks song. And so I'm losing my train of thought, but I got it, I get it back. So, we performed it on the final performance and kind of came up with a tune based off this, the Craig Taborn tune. Then we went in the studio a few weeks later and we recorded that version. So then I took the stems from the studio recording, I took the stems from the Craig Taborn version, and I took all of those back and had them on my laptop. And I spent weeks working with those recordings and chopping those up into a piece, in which I then recorded the actual lyrics, and I had Jay Horde record lyrics on top of that first. And so it was like 1, 2, 3, 4 different times through cycle of going between human parts and into the laptop and human parts and into the laptop and human parts and into the laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it's basically like a excessive back and forth of, you know, experimenting between those two elements. And so after I did that, I couldn't do it no more. Then we would mix the track. We mixed it on the laptop as well. Me and Paul Wilson, who's a producer on some of the music, and my keyboardist and mixing engineer and everything. And so that's kind of just one example. You know, I didn't record the whole album with one mic, but it's a lot of, you know, going from people's houses and recording parts, or there's bass or sax, or I recorded Sullivan Fortner in his living room. He had a Steinway in his living room, and so I recorded that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like doing field recordings around New York City in different people's environments, you know, and then take it back to my basement and sit with the laptop and the headphones and the mic, you know, just a real basic setup. And
yeah.
That's where the work happens. I spend hours and hours kind of tinkering, you know.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about some of them because, I mean, like Brandy Younger's on this record and, you know,
yeah.
A harp is a tough instrument to record because there's a lot of subtlety to it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And so the thing is that it's not to, yeah, I don't want this to people to misunderstand the story and think like everything was with one mic, you know? And it's because, you know, there's certain times where, okay, on a few tracks, I want to get grand piano or I want harp. And so I'll go into an actual studio and get takes of people playing, you know, to get that quality part. And then I'll take it and put it back in my laptop. And the reason I put it back on my laptop so that the final cut is through me rather than the final cut through working with an engineer. You know what I'm saying? All right, cut 8 measures here and put it there. You know, it's kind of like, because I grew up using MPC 2000s and SR10s and making beats and that kind of vibe, it's like I want the last part of the puzzle to be almost like beat-making energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's something that I'm kind of curious about is because of the background that you come from and that skill that you have, I'm wondering whether, you know, technical limitations become compositional tools in a way.
Totally, 100%. And that's a great, and that also ties back into the monk thing a little bit. It's like the technical limitation almost becomes your defining characteristic in an age of like infinite possibilities and perfection, you know, in the sense of like you can get a perfect BPM, you can get a perfect in tune anything, and you make anything mix with anything. So the imperfections are actually become the thing that makes you you, you know. And a lot of times I force musicians to work in a challenged environment. Like I won't always play the beat that a musician is going to be playing with. You know, sometimes I want to get them playing more loosely.
Uh-huh.
You know, the time to be loose. Because if they're playing with what I'm going to put them on, it has less of a sample feel. It's more like, okay, well, that's a pianist and a drummer, you know. But if you add the piano playing by themselves, and you collage the drums in later, it really has that feel of the boom bap feel that I love so much, you know.
Yeah, you did 6 shows at the Jazz Gallery that were recorded, and bits and pieces from that are on this record, like you were talking about the bit with Craig Taborn. The one that I only saw one of them, and it was the one with Jason Moran. There's nothing from there on this record, right?
Unfortunately, no. But I actually do have a piece. I did the same thing I did with the Craig, where I took a piece of the Jason Moran. I had a piece of Jason Moran playing a Ravel piece.
Mm-hmm.
Did live. And then I took that and put it on the sample pad, the SPDS sample pad, and we recorded on top of that in the studio. And it was actually super dope. I just never got around to like making it, you know, into a thing. But I might use it on the next album because it was super dope. And that's the thing. It's not a lack of material. There's so much material. You know, it's just that the process for me, process of making a thing, is like, it takes a lot of time and energy. And so you just gotta, you know, you gotta decide you're gonna go all the way there, you know, and work on it. It's done.
Do you see yourself going into a traditional studio and making like an old school everybody play at the same time kind of jazz record under your own name, or is that not really something that you're interested in, that traditional live methodology?
100%. I think that the funny thing, I mean, you could tell from, you know, from working with Jerry Allen and stuff like that, like I'm a drummer. I'm a jazz drummer, you know, and I actually love playing the drums just straight up with, you know, 3 acoustic instruments, and I definitely plan on doing that. I just gotta figure out the right time for it to fit in the novel that is my body of work, you know, because I think I'm getting to something right now with the type of music I'm making, and I want to see that through. But also, I'm not trying to say like that's the only thing I want to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have a duo. Well, so I did a duo thing with Sullivan Fortner at the Jazz Gallery, and it went really well. We thought about putting that out as an album, but then we performed at Earshot in Seattle. And we performed at So What's Next in the Netherlands. And it was like, man, it was one of the best sets of music I've been a part of, you know. And it was 60 minutes of improvisation. And he had a piano, organ, and Rhodes. I think he had an organ. Yeah, piano, organ, and Rhodes. I had, you know, drums and affected vocals and a MIDI keyboard, and it was all live, you know. And I would love to do that project with him, to be honest. I'm gonna see if he'll do it.
Yeah,
I'm gonna make him in his label if we can do, make it happen.
So presenting music like this, like, you know, on the new record. There's, I mean, at the Winter Jazz Fest, you attract a certain audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you find that audience outside New York? Like, this doesn't feel like the kind of music that you can take on tour playing jazz clubs and reach the people that it needs to reach. So do you perform in, like, you know, other types of venues and stuff like that? Like, what do you try and, you know, who are you looking to reach on the road?
Well, I think that there's two ways to go about that. I did my first tour in November in Europe, and it was mostly a duo tour, and it was primarily jazz venues, clubs, festivals, and a lot of the audience was not the audience that would expect to hear what they heard.
Mm-hmm.
But the way I present it, because I've spent so many years playing jazz clubs and playing for certain types of audiences, I'm coming out of that. Like, even though this sounds a lot different, I'm coming out of that tradition a lot more than people would expect, you know. And so when I play it live, it's like I'm trying to put a frame on it so that you can see how it's connected, you know. It's like I love playing for the audience that's like, I don't like hip hop, or like, I love jazz until this particular year, and then I lost interest, you know. Mm-hmm. I love playing for them and them hearing, experiencing what I do, and then they have to go home and kind of reevaluate, like, wait, maybe I'm the problem, you know. maybe that spirit that I love in 19 whatever is an infinite eternal spirit, and it's always there, and you have to just, you know, wait for it to come around, you know. Like, it's, for me, I hate the idea of crystallizing a timeless spirit in a moment, saying this is when all was well and everything after is, you know, invalid, you know. I just think it's like more like a cycle, and you don't want to get caught not riding the wave of, you know, that timeless spirit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a little outside, but so because of that, I like playing for older people. I like playing for people that prefer acoustic music, because when they hear what I'm doing with the electronics, or they hear what I'm doing with the pop elements, and they hear me fit it into languages they already know and love, it opens them up. And then as far as the newer audience that would get what I'm doing from the record, I'm hoping to open them up to the lineage and the tradition of where it comes from. So we'll do one of my songs, and then we'll open up and we'll go free, and we'll take it, you know, we'll take it here, we'll take it there. And if they're already rocking with me, they'll take a trip with me, you know. So it's kind of a twofold process of exposing people to things they might not already know.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it is. There's the two, you know, there's the two audiences. And so that's what I'm kind of curious about, is that second audience, the young hip-hop R&B audience. Like, where mm-hmm. do you... Where are they going on a Friday night that you could play and, you know, bring them in? You know, is there,
yeah,
are you aware of a touring circuit for that yet, or are you trying to figure it out?
Yeah, I'm working on it. But that being said, the quote unquote jazz audience is experiencing, new growth, if you will. There's like seedlings of listeners that are able to break down what a lot of the legends in jazz music have laid down for us. You know, it's like people's ears are opening up. So I think that it's those two audiences that I expressed to you, that's getting to be less of a strict divide, you know? Like, you'll have older people that are also into new stuff and younger people that are going and digging up records after hearing somebody, like, even somebody like Flying Lotus, you know, and go like, okay, well, look, I love this. I love Madlib, but what does Madlib love? You know, and then they start opening up. And so, I don't know. I think those two audiences, I almost would rather not even think about it, you know, and just try to, like, make something that takes care of both of those objectives of reaching both of them for the different reasons at the same time, you know. And no matter where I'm at, I'm going to make people uncomfortable. If I'm in the jazz club, you know what I mean? If I'm in the jazz club, they're going to be like, hey, like, cool out, youngster, you know. And then if I'm in the more hip-hop club, you know, there's going to be a certain time in the set where it's not like an easy rhythm that they can bob their head to, and I'm going to start glitching out, you know, on the drums, and we're going to start going out there, you know? So no matter where I play, it's not the perfect place. And that's just because what I'm bringing isn't really, there hasn't been a house built for this yet, you know? It's different, you know? And I don't think I have the same, I don't think other artists that are coming out right now that are kind of like hip hop jazz fusion type artists, I don't think they have that same kind of problem as I do, because I'm mixing more like, at least for the new album, the way I'm thinking about it, I'm mixing like rap sonics with like avant-garde approaches, you know. I'm trying to take it outside, and I want the rap part not to be jazzy, you know what I mean? I want it to, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's not like a blend, you know? And I love Tribe Called Quest, and I love J Dilla, and all of that, you know what I mean? But as far as what I'm making, it's just a kind of a different, it don't mix well, you know? It's like, it's a little like abrasive almost, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading years ago about, you know, Bill Laswell would put mm-hmm. people together from all sorts of backgrounds, and he came up with this phrase that he called collision music, because yes. It's not about, his whole thing was not about combining them in a way that worked naturally. It was about throwing people at each other and saying, you and you play together, you know,
yeah.
And figure something out. And a lot of the time, you know, it would work. And a lot of the time, and sometimes it would be a collision, you know, it would be like, no, it doesn't work.
I just popped into my head. I had a memory of, I had a gig at the Jazz Gallery, like, let's see, what year is it? 2020. I had a gig at the Jazz Gallery about 10 years ago, and I actually forgot that I even had this gig, but maybe 8 years ago, and I played solo, and then I brought up a bunch of my different friends to play, you know, to like do improvisations and little sketches and stuff, and somehow I got Peter Evans to get up and play a song with Eric Lewis.
Wow.
Elu. Right? Now, do you know Peter Evans and Eric Lewis?
Uh-huh.
As far as, right, you know, you're familiar. Yeah, so the thing was, to me, they were both, like, oddly similar in a certain way, you know, because they both, like, technical masterminds, you know what I mean, and twisted sense of humor. And, you know, I just was like, man, I'd love to hear what these guys make. and they got up and played something together, and I swear it was like the best thing on the show. But I could tell they were both like, what the hell, you know, like, what was that? You know, they both had their qualms, you know. I could just tell it was uncomfortable, but it sounded incredible, man. I think, like, if they did an album together, it'd probably be like the best thing.
I remember, man, I don't even know, this must have been like 20 years ago, because Tonic closed, you know, a long time ago.
Tonic.
But I remember one night I saw John Zorn and Derek Bailey there, but they had Reggie Workman on bass. And it was like, you know, it seemed like it would be two completely different languages, but, you know, they put it all together, you know?
I feel like people don't do that as much these days. You know, I mean, I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just not checking for it, but the weird, like, we're going to put these weird mixes of musicians together and just, you know, people are going to love it, you know, and we're going to have Reggie Workman. You know, that seems to happen all the time, honestly.
Yeah.
I played at Tonic once.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. I can't even remember. It was some random gig. I think I was subbing for Cindy Blackman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I saw her once. I saw her with Pharoah Sanders in the mid-90s, when Iridium was still uptown by Lincoln Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was before my time.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Okay, that was my conversation with Casa Overall, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. Subscribers are now getting to see articles several days before they appear on the main Burning Ambulance website, so visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can spare it. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.